This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. The NFL season is underway. The Eagles won their first game against Washington under the high-octane playbook of their new coach, Chip Kelly. They had 30 plays in the first quarter. It's Kelly's first year as a coach in the NFL. Can the team sustain this speed of play? Is it a winning strategy against other teams? And how will quarterback Mike Vick hold up? We asked Ray Didinger to join us. He covers the Eagles for Comcast Sportsnet. And Ray, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. If you want to talk about the Eagles, you better call now, 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Ray, have you caught your breath from Monday night's game?
I'll tell you, Marty, one of the problems, I can sympathize with what the Washington Redskins defense was going through Monday night, trying to keep up with that Eagles offense because, I try to take play-by-play handwritten notes as the game's going along, and I couldn't do it. I mean, it used to be in the past when Andy Reid was calling the plays. This was a team that always huddled and kind of walked to the line of scrimmage, and they took the 30-second clock all the way down to the bottom of it. So you had lots of time to take notes and even write in the margins. Not so much anymore. I found myself two or three plays behind. But hey, listen, it was fun to watch, and it certainly worked. They're 1-0 at this point. Not a whole lot of people thought that they'd be sitting there right now.
Someone ran the math, and they said it was a play every 22 seconds.
Yes, and then Chip Kelly said the next day at his press conference that was too slow. and it's really, I don't know how many of the Eagles fans really watched a lot of Chip Kelly's offense at Oregon, but really this is the way he played with his college team. I mean, this is the way they played, and you're seeing more and more teams in college football and even now some teams in the NFL that are trying to play at a much faster pace. That seems to be the new trend now. But nobody does it. Nobody does it to the extent that Chip Kelly does. I mean, that's why Jeff Lurie, the owner of the Eagles, brought him in because he felt that this was the wave of the football future, and he thought that Chip Kelly was the coach that could put him and his team ahead of the curve.
But if there's no huddle and you're essentially sort of setting up for the next play as soon as you've completed the last one, how do you know what to do?
Hand signals from the sidelines.
Okay.
All the players, the quarterback has a radio transmitter in his helmet. So the coach is talking to the quarterback the whole time. So as the plays are, as you're in that little bit of time between the plays, as the team is catching up to the ball and they're getting ready to line up, the head coach is talking to the quarterback through his helmet. And the other players are getting hand signals from the sidelines. If you see when they show, for the fans who want to watch the game on Sunday, well, look at the sidelines when they show cutaways of Chip Kelly. You'll see Chip Kelly talking, and he's talking to Mike Vick, but you'll see two or three assistant coaches standing on either side of Kelly who are giving hand signals almost like a baseball third base coach, and they're signaling the plays in to the other players while the coach is talking to the quarterback.
Does that change practice when you play that way?
Well, the Eagles have been practicing this way now since Chip Kelly got the job. I mean, all through the spring, through what they call OTAs, which is organized team activities, and then through the summer in training camp, they've been practicing this very thing. All the hand signals, all the flashcards that the guys on the sidelines hold up that have various pictures that also tell players about the plays and the formations and stuff. I mean, it's all sent in. I mean, everything. It's all the same stuff you would get done in the huddle. It's just that they're doing it now on the fly.
But it might work with college players who are younger, one would assume, I'm not sure if they're fitter or not, but nonetheless, do you think this will work for NFL players? And is it sustainable through a season?
No, that's the question, Marty, and that's the question everybody's asking. I mean, everybody, even the most skeptical, old-school NFL stick in the muds. I mean, had to be impressed with what they saw on Monday night. I mean, it was very effective, and it was revolutionary, and it was exciting, and it was fun. I mean, even if you were a real skeptic, I mean, you had to come away from Monday night and say, wow, that was pretty cool. But it was one game, right. And now the question for the people who remain a little skeptical, the question that they would ask is, okay, that was fine, but it was one game. You know, can an NFL team sustain that over the course of 16 weeks in an NFL season? And that's a very legitimate question. We don't know. I mean, no one's really tried to do it like this. I mean, the New England Patriots did it last year to a lesser degree. The New England Patriots ran more plays than any team in football last year, and that's and that's really kind of a carryover from their head coach, Bill Belichick, actually went up in the offseason and went to school with Chip Kelly and kind of sat down with Chip Kelly and saw how he did things at Oregon. Huh. And then he took the same principles and brought them to New England and applied them to the Patriots last year. And so they ran more plays than any team, and it certainly worked for them. But, you know, can you do it? Can a team like this do it over the course of a full season? I don't know. The Patriots were able to do it. I don't know if that applies to every team, because you're right. In college, you have as many as, you know, Chip Kelly had anywhere from 90 to 100 players.
Wow.
So you know, they weren't working as hard at practice. They got a little bit of a break at practice. In the NFL, you only have 53 players, and, you know, a lot of them are in their 30s, and they're older guys, and there's a lot of wear and tear there. And over the course of the season, you know, a lot of your guys are injured and banged up, and on any given day at practice, you have five or six guys who can't practice. So, you know, that those numbers begin to shrink, and if the numbers begin to shrink, you can't really practice at the same pace at the risk of wearing guys out. So that's the question, Marty. For one game, yes, it was very exciting and dynamic, but can you sustain it over a full season? That remains to be seen.
And that's our Ray Didinger, and we're talking about the Eagles and their new coach and how they played on Monday night, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Ray, let me get Dave from Marlton, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Ray, you are by far my favorite analyst.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
And I really respect your opinion. I'm wondering, you know, it was so exciting to watch that game. That was just phenomenal. But, you know, as an Eagle fan, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, all right, how is the NFL going to do us in on this one? And I'm watching Redskin players go down with Charlie horses, and by the end of the game, our own players look like, pretty wore out. And I'm thinking, is the NFL going to somehow stop us from being able to do this because of the fear of injuring players?
What do you think, Ray?
Even some of the Eagle players were laughing after the game about what they thought were Redskin players faking injuries, lying on the ground, grabbing the back of their calves, you know, saying, I got a Charlie horse, I got a cramp. And listen, you know, first game of the season, playing at that pace, it's entirely possible you could cramp up. It could be that some of those guys were legitimately cramping, and it's also possible that some of those guys were faking it to stop the clock and give their defense a chance to regroup. I don't doubt that for a second. And that's, you know, the league will try, I mean, they'll send out memos to teams to discourage them from doing it, and they're going to say, we can't do this, it makes us look bad. But you can't really stop them from doing it. I mean, you can't throw a flag and penalize a team for saying you're faking an injury. Well, how do you prove that? So that's, I mean, they're going to talk about it, and they're going to tell teams, look, don't do this, don't abuse this, it looks foolish if you do. But the fact of the matter is, if teams want to do it, it's hard to stop them from doing it. And it is one way to stop that offense. It is one way to make them wait and slow everything down and break their momentum. And I'm sure the Redskins did it to some degree Monday night, not all that successfully, but they did it. And I'm sure teams will continue to do it for as long as they feel the need to do it.
Dave, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What are your hopes for Michael Vick?
Well, if you're an Eagles fan, what you got to hope is that he plays 16 games.
Right. And not get injured, obviously.
And you know, Mike has played a long time, but he's only played in his entire career, for as long as he's played, he's only made it through an entire season just once.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's his history. Regardless of where he was, regardless of what kind of offense he was playing in, the way Mike plays, I mean, he takes a lot of hits. He plays pretty recklessly. He doesn't protect himself very much. He's not the biggest guy in the world. So he takes hits and he gets hurt, you know. And that's, I would be very surprised if he makes it through the season without an injury. I mean, you saw on Monday night, by the fourth quarter, he had to come off the field, and at an exchange of possessions, and you saw him limping off the field. And that's, every week, if you're an Eagles fan, you're going to be holding your breath. And, you know, the coaches talk to Mike about protecting himself, and when you run with the ball, get out of bounds, or when you run with the ball, dive, don't take the big hit. But, this is a guy that, in the game on Monday night, you saw him running downfield, throwing blocks for his backs. I mean, that's, you can talk all you want about him protecting himself, and he will sometimes say, listen, I understand, I got to be smarter. But once he gets in the middle of the game, the competitor takes over, and he's going to do what he feels like he has to do to help his team win. The only trouble is that kind of style of play, it sometimes is effective, but it always puts him at risk.
How would you compare the personalities of Chip Kelly and Andy Reid?
Very different. Very, very different. I mean, the personalities of the two men are as different as their styles of play, really. Chip Kelly, plays fast and talks fast and thinks fast. You know, and Andy Reid was much more methodical. He was methodical in the way he considered questions before he answered them. He talked slower and he played slower. Chip Kelly talks fast and he plays fast. But the one thing that I think is, you know, Andy was very successful. He had 14 years here in Philadelphia, won more games than any Eagles coach, took him to a Super Bowl. But you know, by the end, I mean, his program and his system had gone stale. It really had. I mean, the veteran players, and to this day, they respect him, and they know that he made them a good team. But at the end, I think they recognized it was time for a change, and they've changed over to a totally different style of coaching, a totally different style of football. And you see, this team is really excited. I mean, the way these guys are hustling, going downfield, throwing the extra block. I mean, there's a level of excitement and energy here that's directly traceable to the new coach and the program that he's brought in. I mean, these guys have, one of the things that you have to have in pro football before you can have success is your players have to buy into your program. They have to believe in you, and they have to believe what you're putting on the blackboard. And at this point, the Eagles, to a man, believe in Chip Kelly.
You mentioned the word Super Bowl. There's been one game, I understand, Ray, but is that, do you think that's even in the cards, or is that crazy talk?
You know, I would say, you know, it's, I would say it's, I don't want to say it's crazy talk, because I think it's unlikely. I think it's unlikely. But listen, I mean, last year the Washington Redskins went from last place in the NFC East to first place and in the playoffs. And it happens a lot. The teams go from being on the bottom one year to being at the top the following year. So every year there's always going to be, and one year you can, one thing you can count on in the NFL is every year there's going to be at least one or two teams that are going to go from last place to first place and surprise everybody in the process. And it's very possible that maybe the Eagles are going to be one of those teams this year. I think offensively, you know, a couple things have to happen. You have to keep your key players healthy. I mean, Shady McCoy and Michael Vick have to stay healthy to keep the offense going. And the other thing is on the defense, I still think that they have some problems on defense. I still think they have some holes on defense. And until they can shore those up, I think it's probably a little bit of a stretch to think that they could go to the Super Bowl. But could they possibly win this division? Marty, it's not a very good division. You know, I mean, they could sneak in there and do that. Right now, I wouldn't bet on it. But listen, if you're a fan and you want to believe, go ahead and believe.
Well, that sounds smoking like a true Eagles fan with obviously both fingers crossed as you say that. Ray, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us in this very first portion of Radio Times.
Always my pleasure, Marty. Take care.
You too. And that's Ray Didinger. He covers the Eagles for Comcast Sportsnet. He's written a number of books, including The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies. And coming up, we'll be talking with Ken Belson from The New York Times about the settlement just a couple of weeks ago. In fact, a court here in Philadelphia deciding on or settling a lawsuit having to do with concussions in former players. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
HealthyFoodNow.com is an online community inspired by Dr. Joel Fuhrman's nutritarian principles and supporter of WHYY. Healthy Food Now delivers nutrient-rich meals, nutrition coaching, and lifestyle resources. More at HealthyFoodNow.com.
What can you do when your township sprays toxins to control weeds? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss your options when frogs and toads are looking at you to be their Batman. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Secretary of State John Kerry will meet with Russia's foreign minister to hammer out a deal on Syria's chemical weapons.
Help us in the next days working with Russia to work out the formula by which those weapons can be transferred to international control and destroyed.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Late in August, the NFL settled a lawsuit with 4,500 former players and their families who had accused the league of covering up the risks of concussions. The NFL agreed to pay out $765 million. So what does this mean for the players, the league, and for research and treatment for brain damage associated with repeated hits to the head? Well, joining us now is Ken Belson. He's a sports reporter for the New York Times, where he covers the business of sports, including franchise sales, ticket stadiums, and other topics, including this one. And Ken Belson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. I was just talking with Ray Dinger about the start of the NFL season, and it's interesting that this settlement came right before the NFL season started. Do you think there was some coincidence there, or the timing was important?
Timing was definitely important. The judge in the case, who, as you mentioned in your lead-in, is in Philadelphia, it was something called multi-district litigation, which is to say there were hundreds of these cases that were all brought together in this federal court in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. She extended the deadline from July to September 3rd, and I'm sure it wasn't coincidental that the season was about to start. I think she knew that that would put leverage on the NFL to help push them along towards a settlement.
And we're talking about a settlement of $765 million, something like 4,500 plaintiffs. What are some of the terms of the settlement?
A very interesting settlement. The dollar figure is set at $765 million. People have said that seems low. I think that's based primarily on a couple of things. One is that the figures that were bandied around in court by some insurance companies were in the billions, right. And I think that got some people's expectations up. The second thing is a lot of people have compared the $765 million to the $10 billion in revenue that the NFL brings in every year. And while that's one way of looking at it, you can't really look at revenue. You really need to look at profits, and the NFL doesn't publish its profits, so we really don't know how profitable they are, but we can assume they are. And so that might lead you to believe it's a little more money's coming out of the owner's pockets. Having said that, we don't know how much the insurance companies are going to cover, and even if they cover, say, half of the NFL's damages or settlement case there, you know, that really shrinks the number quite significantly. And then, of course, you have to divide all of that by 32 teams. And this is really one of the key details, they don't have to pay it all at once.
Right.
They have to pay half of it in the first 3 years and the remainder over 17 years. So when you really work out the numbers, you're not looking at more than the equivalent of $1 million or $2, maybe even $5 million a team per year. It's not a lot of money when you're bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars. That's the financial way of looking at this issue.
Now, the NFL, I mean, the plaintiffs were essentially accusing the NFL of covering up the risks of concussion from all those hits to the head. Did the NFL admit wrongdoing or admit covering up as part of this agreement?
No, and there's, you know, in settlements of this kind, that's part of the reason they're made, is that the league or defendant in any of these cases doesn't have to admit any wrongdoing. This is the way of making the problem go away.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned 4,500 plaintiffs before, and that's, in fact, the rough number of people added to these lawsuits. But, in fact, what the NFL did was very clever. They took their $765 million, gave it to, or said, we'll pay the plaintiffs. But the pool of plaintiffs now includes all retired players, 18,000 or so, which means that it's essentially indemnifying itself from future lawsuits. You can't have, it's very unlikely that a player who was not part of this lawsuit can turn around and sue the league and say, well, I still believe you committed fraud, because a judge is going to say, well, this has really been settled, and you, the retired player, have more or less been party to it. Of course, the players can opt out in any of these settlements. Players can decide not to take part. And already some have hinted they won't. But cases like this, once they're settled on behalf of all players, it's going to be hard for a judge to say that they haven't had their day in court.
You profiled a number of players, including Forrest Gregg in an article in the New York Times, an offense tackle, and his degree of disability and just the challenges of him living his life. Can you talk a bit about him?
Yeah, he was also a coach. He's a very well-known player, played on the Packers teams in the 60s. He was somebody, I think what's remarkable about him is, and if you look at the 4,500 plaintiffs and where they fit sort of demographically, he was one of those older players that, it was almost unbecoming of him to sue the league. First of all, he loved the league. He'd worked in it more or less his entire professional life. And secondly, he's a sort of, I don't want to generalize too much, but the sort of older generation that, doesn't go around suing employers. That's something young, people do. But his condition deteriorated during this period, and he finally did sign on. Yeah. And I think that it was remarkable in that sense. I think there's a lot of young players, different generation, different sense of loyalty to employers. Those players didn't have any trouble putting their name on the dotted line. When a gentleman of his stature got involved, I think it was a signal, particularly to the league, too, that that this had was a lot bigger issue than just a couple of rowdy players who were having problems.
And we're talking about, really worrisome of mental, disabilities or mental issues, physical ones as well. Can you talk a bit about what some of these players are charging or describing as a result of playing football?
Setting aside the fraud issue, which is really, what the NFL knew and when it knew it and what
right.
it shared or didn't share.
Right.
That's a whole separate part of the case. The other case is that they were treated negligently and their injuries are partly, the league is partly responsible for not taking care of them while they were playing. There's many cases of ALS, players with ALS, Parkinson's, advanced dementia, at an accelerated age. So we're not talking about players. Of course, there are players in their 60s and 70s with these conditions, but we're talking about players in their 40s now that have joined this case. I quoted a gentleman, Kevin Turner, who actually, I believe, paid for the Eagles several years. And he said, I don't think, if this case had dragged out for 5 years, I don't think I would have been part of any potential victory because his ALS is really quite advanced.
Mm.
I don't have, there haven't been numbers published of, what percentage of the 4,500 players have ALS. You can imagine in a case like this that the plaintiff's lawyers are going to put some of the players with the worst conditions forward to illustrate the problem. And sadly, quite a few players were represented by their wives because they committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's, no matter how you slice it, that's especially several of the players who shot themselves in the chest so their brains could be studied. This is this is not something the NFL ever wanted to continue, and so it behooved them to come to the settlement table as well.
Ken, let me just reintroduce you. That's Ken Belson. He's a sports reporter for the New York Times. He writes about the business of sports, and we called him up, asked him to join us to talk about this settlement just a couple of weeks ago. In fact, took place here in Philadelphia. The NFL settled a lawsuit with former players and their families had accused the league of covering up the risks of concussion. The NFL agreed to pay out $765 million. We're talking about what's included in the settlement and some of the players that Ken has profiled, and we're interested in your questions and comments, especially if you are a fan of football. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ken, you mentioned some of the players who had committed suicide, including an Eagles defensive back, Andre Waters, who committed suicide in 2006, and his his brain was studied to look for signs of CTE.
Yes, and at this stage, it's interesting. There was a wave of scientific evidence coming out, actually starting with Andre Waters' death and later diagnosis on through the last few years, and mounting numbers of these autopsies done, well over 100 now. And by the way, not just the football players professionally, but college and high school players or former high school players who had died, and soldiers who had absorbed, been involved in large explosions overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these mounting evidence had shown there was a correlation between concussions and and head trauma and dementia and this CTE. It's interesting, you get to a point where this starts to mount, and then you get people saying this doesn't really exist. And it's an odd parallel with, say, climate change, when you start to get people saying, well, this really doesn't exist at all. For a while, people just ignored it, and then when the evidence accumulates, people start saying, well, that's not really evidence. And we started to hear that, too. But, you know, these are very well-respected neurosurgeons and neuroscientists doing this research at some of the top universities around the country and at the National Institute for Health. So when that starts to accumulate, they're scary findings. Having said all that, and you know, scientists are correct in saying there's still so much more we don't know, and one of the key medical questions still to be answered, and it will take many years, is why some players seem to get these injuries or diseases earlier, while other players who played in the same games under the same conditions don't. It could be genetic, it could be demographic, it could be a whole host of other things. And there's so much we don't know. We don't know how many concussions kids, these players absorbed as kids. So the cumulative evidence is still very blurry, so to speak. And so it's going to be many, many years. And as part of the $765 million settlement, $10 million was hived off for research into this ailment. Unfortunately, that's really just a drop in the bucket, but it is an acknowledgement anyway that that the settlement, that the NFL recognizes that this is an issue and will remain one.
Some of the doctors, I guess, researchers, scientists that you interviewed said that there's really a need for a big population study, I guess, to look at all the things that you just said about why some people seem to get some injuries, some don't. Does it have something to do with playing in high school? All those question marks, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. What type of equipment people used, what kind of fields they played on, how quickly, if they had concussions, were they allowed to return to play? There are so many of these variables in the life of a player. I mean, by the time they get to the professional level, they've already been playing at least 10 years and probably more under, you know, such variety of conditions. A kid in Texas versus a kid in Philadelphia, it's going to be very different winter versus summer, training in the off season. You know, even just somebody who played soccer in the, you know, one season and or basketball in addition to football. So population study will follow or is intended to follow these people through many years. It's interesting, there is some research or actually a growing amount of research being done with kids, usually with accelerometers, these sort of measures inside the helmets of these kids that measure how many blows they take a game. And there's a whole host of devices being produced now by companies like Reebok and others to warn players and coaches that that player may have suffered a concussion, with little red light meters and all sorts of other things. A whole sort of sub-industry built around head protection has come out. Unfortunately, none of it will fully insulate a player from concussions, and I'm sure your next guest is going to discuss this too.
Sure.
And that's going to come back to training or not playing football at all. I mean, it's similar with air travel. If you want to reduce your risk or eliminate your risk of getting in an air crash, just never get in a plane. And it's the same with football. If you're afraid of a neck injury or a brain injury, then perhaps just don't play the sport.
Well, but it does seem, at least anecdotally, that more coaches are taking the possibility of concussion and injury more seriously. And that's, as I say, just sort of anecdotally, when you hear players, even high school players today, versus a generation or two ago.
Yeah, absolutely, and for good reason. The coaches and the players like the game, and they want it to continue. Right. In fact, you know, even Kevin Turner, the player I mentioned, a former player who has ALS, openly says he loves the NFL, and he wants the NFL to continue. And this settlement was not about hurting the NFL. It was about helping him through the last few years of his life. And I think, you know, look, rationally, if you want the game to continue and you don't want something out of the blue like congressional oversight, for instance, or, turning the game into flag football, well, then you'd, of course, try and do things to mitigate the injuries. And that's just that's good behavior. And it's not just anecdotal. I mean, the USA Football, which is a nonprofit partially funded by the league, is out there holding clinics on how to tackle safely and how to coach properly. One of the things we had in the story around the day of the settlement raised an interesting point, which is in most sports, the youth league, for example, baseball, think about how kids play baseball. They start in T-ball, and then as they grow, they're allowed to throw, say, 50 pitches, and they go through a little league until they get to high school. And then as they turn to pros, they play the most advanced version of that game in perhaps the most dangerous conditions. In football, it's almost the opposite now. You have the NFL, which is practically doing no contact in practices, or very little, and you have Pop Warner and other youth leagues still having full contact practices when the kids, in effect, are at their most vulnerable point. So we have this sort of inverted situation where the kids are still playing, and obviously some of that's changing, but still practicing with more contact than the pros play, the pros use. So I think that's something that's probably going to be evened out over time.
I don't know. I mean, you cover the business of football or the business of sports, but this is a fan question, whether the fans of football, you know, they want the sort of smash mouth game. They want the contact. They want they want an exciting thing to happen on the field.
Yeah, I attended one of the opening days on Sunday. And it's very clear that there is a, the NFL remains popular both as a game to see in person and obviously on television. And violent hits or, body-crunching tackles, that's still a part of the game. I watched the Eagles-Redskins game, and, players were still stomping up and down. And, of course, the Washington fans weren't happy. But when the quarterback was sacked, that's what the game is about. I don't think anybody can fully take that away. But, I think of hockey, and I grew up in the 70s watching hockey, when, pretty much every game included some sort of brawl with both sides of the team leaving their benches. There'd be five or six sets of boxing matches going on the ice, and it would take 20 minutes to clear the ice. Of course, Philadelphia Flyers were famous for that.
Indeed.
And eventually it became regulated, right? It was, if you leave the bench, you're thrown out of the game. If you're the third man in, you're thrown out of the game, to the point where we see a fight maybe once every two or three games now. And we still see hockey, and it's still just as exciting. And the fighting has been mitigated over time. And concussions is still a big issue, and it still is a violent game in many ways. But they've just taken the fighting out. And I can see in the long term how the NFL will start doing that by penalizing players, fining them for dangerous hits. We saw this with a player on the Detroit Lions with an unnecessary low hit on a player's knees. That wasn't a head injury, but it had the same sort of enforcement mechanism.
Ken, can you hold on? We're looking for our third guest. He teaches at a high school, so we're going to track him down. But I do want to talk with you about the Frontline documentary you've written about that after this short break. Can you stay with us for a couple of minutes?
Sure.
Okay, and that's Ken Belson, sports reporter for the New York Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Elizabeth House supports WHYY and announces the first annual Workforce Opportunities Conference, Wednesday, September 25th at the Chase Center on the Riverfront in Wilmington. The conference links those searching for traditional employment, contract work, small business ventures, and volunteer opportunities with business and government employers, staffing agencies, and educational institutions. Sponsored in part by the Company Corporation. To register online, events.theelizabethhouse.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Billie Jean King. She won 20 Wimbledons and championed equal pay for women in tennis, but is best known for taking on and beating Bobby Riggs 40 years ago in what became a battle of the sexes.
Every day, I at least get one or more people coming up to me. Most people, if they're old enough, remember exactly where they were that day.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
In the event of a U.S. government takeover, federal disaster planners inadvertently take over the U.S. government and ditch the Constitution.
There are 48 presidential emergency active directives sitting in envelopes, giving to a set of people who we don't know to take over the country.
next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about football. Began with Ray Didinger talking about the Eagles. Talking now with Ken Belson, sports reporter for the New York Times. And just in a minute or two, talking with Ed Dunn from Martin Luther King High School. Ken, just a quick question to you, if you don't mind. You wrote about this Frontline documentary that's gotten a lot of play called League of Denial, the NFL Concussions and the Battle for Truth. This was ESPN and kind of signed on to this, and then they broke apart from this. I guess what's the short version of this Frontline documentary?
Well, the documentary, which is supposed to air early next month, will detail over many years how the NFL, investigated the concussion issue and the concussion injury rates, and what safety information it did or didn't share with the players at the time. And profile some of the key decision makers. And I think if you can probably extrapolate based on Frontline's involvement, they would definitely have a point of view. They've been working on this for more than a year with ESPN.
Right.
But when the trailer came out in early August, I think the NFL, we understood the NFL was rather disturbed at some of the tone. If you will, I'm trying to be polite here.
Yes, I hear you.
Some of the tone of the upcoming documentary, and put pressure subtly or otherwise on ESPN, and ESPN sort of did contortions to get out of the agreement with Frontline. It will still be aired largely with ESPN's research, but ESPN will not be promoting it. And so it was a victory for those who think there's a conspiracy at large between the NFL and ESPN. But, you know, frankly, the NFL is in the marketing business. They market a product, and the product is football. And this documentary, to their view, was a little over the top, and so exerted what pressure they could on a vendor of theirs or a customer of theirs, and that's ESPN. So, it doesn't surprise me, but I think unfortunately for them, it's probably going to bring more people to watch it than would have otherwise.
Well, I was going to say that. And Ken Belson, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Pleasure.
And he's a sports reporter for the New York Times. Germantown High School in Philadelphia closed in June. Most of its students transferred to Martin Luther King High School. Math teacher Ed Dunn, who lost his job in June, was recently rehired. He's also the coach of King's football team, the Cougars. Part of his job is to help ease the merger between these two schools and to create one team out of two rivals. He was featured in a heartwarming and, I have to say, heartbreaking story in the New York Times recently, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Ed Dunn, nice to have you with us on the show.
Good morning.
This is the first week of school. How are things going at Martin Luther King?
Everything's going pretty well. Obviously, it's a new era for Martin Luther King and for Northwest Philadelphia, and we're embracing it. We're excited about having a big, comprehensive high school in Northwest Philadelphia that can serve all the children for the future.
And what you're talking about, something like 1,300 students, right?
Correct. We had 1,300 students the first day of school.
There was a lot of worry that this would be a difficult week. There might be fights or conflicts. It sounds like things went pretty smoothly at Martin Luther King.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of that stuff was overblown, and especially concerning the Germantown-Martin Luther King merger, and it brings so many new faces and different neighborhoods and into one building. But we haven't seen that to be a problem at all. At the end of the day, Germantown and Martin Luther King were separated by maybe a half a mile to a mile. So a lot of these kids already knew each other, were living in the same neighborhoods, and I just think it's one of those concerns that just was overblown based on maybe some of the things that have happened in the past and because of the reputation or people's perception of the schools. But so far, I also serve as a dean and work with the discipline piece, and that Martin Luther King, Germantown rivalry or whatever, that we haven't, seen any of that.
Well, that's good news indeed. Now, you worked at Germantown, taught math there, and you were one of the coaches there at Germantown for the Germantown Bears. How different are the facilities at King?
The facilities, well, I think it's completely different because when we were at Germantown, none of the football-related facilities were actually at the school. We practiced off-campus. At Martin Luther King, they actually have on-campus facilities in terms of a practice field and those things. So it actually makes it a lot easier for us because kids don't have to commute from the school to go to practice. They can just walk right out back, and that allows us to do tutoring and study hall after school, as well as having proximity to the weight room and gym, as well as classrooms to do some of the other things that we need to do football-wise. And so it's actually been a great opportunity because we've gotten some of the resources, like all those helmets and shoulder pads and equipment at Germantown. We were able to get some of that stuff, so we're able to accommodate more students, as well as being able to use Benjamin Johnson Stadium for our home games. And so it's actually been, ironically, an upgrade because we've been able to merge the resources of both schools.
I know you spend a lot of the summer, and most of my questions are really just drawn from the profile in the New York Times about you and about the players and these two schools. How did you prepare for this this upcoming season? You've had two games, you've lost them both, but how have you prepared these students to play together?
Well, we started right away. When I was named the head coach back in April, one of my first things was to reach out to the students at Martin Luther King, as well as the students that I already had a relationship that were at Germantown and played for Germantown last year, and give these guys an opportunity to start to interact. So we had I brought the Germantown kids over last spring, and they took a tour of the building and met the principal and other key figures in the building. We also had an interest meeting at the school in the spring that was open to both students at King as well as kids at Germantown. And we also have a cooperative sponsorship with two other schools, Parkway Northwest and Lincoln Hall. And so all those kids got a chance to come over, meet the coaching staff, because it was a new coaching staff for both schools, because I obviously wasn't the head coach at Germantown, and I have a different staff, so they got a chance to meet all the coaches. We, share pizza. They got to share some war stories from playing each other for the last couple of years, and so it actually worked out really well. And from there, we just hit the ground running, and I think what kids realized over time was that, hey, these guys are here for the same reason I'm here. They, we both love this game. We both want to win. We both want to be as good as possible, and so I think that a lot of that friction that could have been created was kind of appeased because we had this unique situation where the football players actually had a head start in this merger, months and months and months before the rest of the school. So whatever kinks we had to work out, we got a chance to work those out, in the spring. And so going through the summer, all we did was bond and work and grow together as a team and as a family.
You were one of the teachers that was laid off in June. You were rehired, but it sounded like even if you had not been rehired, you would have been the coach at King?
Definitely. I always tell my kids that, when you make a commitment to something, that's important that you keep your commitments. And that's how I looked at the situation. I had made a commitment to coach football at the school and to be a part of the kids' lives as a mentor, which is probably the more important role of the two. And so to me, it would be irresponsible of me as an adult and as a role model to step away from that responsibility just because of my circumstances. And so, definitely I'd have been here either way. And I actually was, like I said, we worked all summer, and I didn't know what my situation was going to be. And, I even kept it from the players for a good while, because I didn't want them to worry about it. I wasn't going anywhere.
That's Ed Dunn, and he's a math teacher at Martin Luther King High School here in Philadelphia, also the coach of their football team. And King merged with Germantown High School. I should say Germantown High School was closed in the fall, where Dunn had been working. As he said, he was laid off, got recently rehired, and we're talking about this reconstituted football team and also about the importance of some of these extracurricular activities to students. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And I should say that we read about Ed Dunn in a recent New York Times article. I'm curious, Ed, what has that article done for your program at King?
Oh, it's been great for us. It's given us a lot more attention to the program and some of the things that we're trying to do with the students. And that exposure has allowed us to not only attract more kids to get involved with football and extracurricular activities, but also getting parents involved, getting community involvement, being able to raise the money that we need to do the things that we need to do for these kids. So people, you know, from all walks of life, complete strangers have, you know, reached out and asked, you know, what can I do to help? You know, can I tutor? Can I, you know, donate something? And you know, how can I be involved? And so I think that that profile that the New York Times article created allowed that to happen. And I think what's great about it is that people are excited about this program, not because of the football, but because of everything else that we do outside of football, the mentoring piece, the making sure that our kids are student-athletes and we take their academics very seriously, helping them transition from high school to college. And so people really want to be involved in those pieces. And so it's much bigger than just football, and we have an opportunity to be a role model and be, I guess, the example for the rest of the building of how well this merger can go and that we can really build something special and long-lasting.
Well, and one of the worries with the district and all its financial problems is that extracurricular activities where many students excel and kind of find themselves and they find mentors, that those programs won't be there for other children. I mean, I'm glad to hear what's happening at your school related to sports and academics, but do you worry about other schools?
Yeah, I definitely worry about other schools. I know that one of the big news stories this summer was that they possibly weren't going to fund any athletics, and they were going to cut music and art and all these things. And I think that the extracurricular activities are extremely important to the school experience. And the biggest reason is because it gives the opportunity for adults like me to get an opportunity to interact with kids outside of the classroom and do some of that character development and just helping these guys grow from being teenagers into young adults. And all of these things get kids excited and get kids motivated to do better in the classroom. So even though you don't get a grade or you don't get a degree or a diploma in football, I've seen extracurricular activities, not only just football, but, you know, athletics, music, and art help motivate kids to do better in the classroom because in order to be involved in extracurricular activities, you first have to, you know, take care of your schoolwork. And just that attention, giving those kids that extra attention. I'm at the door every morning making sure that, you know, my kids are there on time, and that extra set of eyes, in addition to, you know, their parents, having that extra set of eyes in the building every day allows these guys to get motivated to be here on time and do well in the classroom.
I was talking to the guests before you about concussions and anyone that works with kids or even adults where there are contacts, it's a contact sport, one has to worry about concussions. What do you do to protect your kids?
Well, we go through all of the necessary precautions, making sure that, you know, all of our equipment fits properly, and making sure that we are just vigilant and aware of what's going on with our kids. You know, our highest concern is to keep these kids safe, and so concussions are definitely one of those hot button issues right now. So
sure,
we are constantly aware of what's going on with our kids, and sometimes we have certain days of practice where we lower the amount of contact because we know that, you know, the more frequent they have those types of violent collisions, the more likely that a concussion will occur. So we just try to limit our exposure to those things by how we organize our practice, and we take it very, very seriously. We have a lot of regulations for our league, the Pennsylvania Athletic Association, PIAA, has set out a whole bunch of regulations for us in terms of concussions, and we follow every single one of those things to the T to make sure that our kids are in the safest situation possible.
And we're almost out of time here, and I'm reluctant to ask you this, but we know the record at King is not so good when it comes to wins and losses.
Mm-hmm.
How does that, as a coach, how do you help your players deal with that?
Well, we had a rough start. We have very high expectations for the season, and obviously so far we haven't performed to the level that we needed to. But our kids are tough. They've been through a lot of transition this summer and have gone through a lot of things just to get to this point. And so if two games is going to make us pack it in and go home, then we didn't do the work that was necessary this summer to build these guys' character and their confidence up. So I think that the biggest thing that we tell our kids every day is that this isn't the end of the story. This is just the beginning of our story. And we are still extremely excited about our prospects for the season, and we're going to continue to play football hard every single week. Friday, we have a new game, and we're going to get back. Our plan is to get back on track, and we're still dreaming of a championship. And until that's taken away, that's what our focus is going to be every single week.
And who are you playing on Friday?
We have Bartram High School. It's a away game at 3 p.m. at Bartram's Field.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show, Edward Dunn. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And good luck on Friday as well.
All right.
And
appreciate it.
You're welcome. And he's a head football coach at Martin Luther King High School, the high school's Cougars. And he's also a teacher at the school where he teaches math. The third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we talked about football. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, he stuffed my head full of football facts. Jessica Crocker is our intern. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.